Welcome to this week's edition of Good Books Radio. Audiobooks.com is the chief underwriter for Good Books Radio, which is produced by UTRGV Media Services for Rio Grande Valley Public Radio. And now, here's your host, Dr. W.F. Strong.
Welcome to this week's edition of Good Books Radio. I'm your host, Dr. W.F. Strong. I want to thank our underwriter, Audiobooks.com, for making this program possible. I'm excited today because we have a wonderful tech-centric book, I would call it, called The Texas Landscape Project. And that is a big title, but you're going to come to understand how important a title it is. It is a handsome volume published by Texas A&M Press, and it is authored by David Todd and Jonathan Ogren. And we have David Todd with us today. David, how are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm delighted. I love this book. I saw actually a kind of advance notice for it, and I love the idea of it before I really fully understood what the idea was, because I saw all the maps and things that you had in here, and I love maps. I love books of maps, but the maps make an argument or they make a case for things. And so before we dig into that, I want to ask you a really tough question. Is based upon all this incredible research that you've done, that's taken a long time, many, many years, no doubt, what is Texas going to look like in, say, 100 years?
Well, you know, that is a really good question. I remember talking once to a fellow named David Sibley, who used to be at Texas A&M University and University of Oklahoma and elsewhere, and he said that people were sort of migrating towards having a kind of density like China, that Texas is, you know, growing by leaps and bounds. I think it's over 26 million people now. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's going to be a very urban place with many, many neighbors.
Mm-hmm. And we have but we will have, a distribution that will be primarily on the east side of I-35 and the west side will remain sparsely populated?
I think that's true. I think that, there's been a migration that's interesting towards the big sort of metropoli of Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, San Antonio. A lot of the growth, interesting, I think, is along that I-35 corridor, as well as down in the Rio Grande Valley. And there are some kind of interesting resource aspects to that, in that a lot of people are choosing to live where water is short and dear. Mm-hmm. And so I think it kind of tees up a question for the future about how we're going to supply water in an equitable way to people who live far from where most of the reservoirs and the big rivers are.
Well, you know, there's been some discussion, I don't think terribly serious because of the cost of things, but people often say, since we often have flooding in East Texas, why don't we pump the water to West Texas? I mean, we pump oil, you know, 3,000 miles. Why can't you pump water?
Well, you know, that's intriguing. It's an idea that's come up before. In fact, back in the 60s, 1968, there was a proposal called the Texas Water Plan. Mm-hmm. And it proposed exactly that, a big canal that would have gone from the Mississippi out to the Panhandle to irrigate all the agriculture out there, and then another canal that would have, I think they called it Burley's Ditch, that would have gone down along the coastal plain all the way to the Rio Grande Valley. Uh-huh. And it was a pretty grand plan, but I think it would have been immensely expensive and would have required a lot of energy to lift that water and pump that water.
Mm-hmm.
And so this plan went to a referendum in the state because a bond was required, and in, I think it was 68, 69, the people of Texas voted it down. And I think that that's always been the hurdle for a lot of these water replumbing plans for the state, is just the enormous cost.
Mm-hmm.
That's entailed, both economically and then also ecologically.
Well, I've heard a lot of the buying of big ranches and things in Texas has little to do with the desire to raise large herds of cattle, but has more to do with water rights.
Well, I think that's true. They call it water ranching, I think, and what it takes advantage of is a law in Texas that's been on the books for about 110 years now, mm-hmm. called the Rule of Capture, and it basically says that you can you would own all the groundwater that you can pump.
Uh-huh.
And so, we've got some pretty large aquifers, and so ranchers have, in some cases, found that they can make more money selling the groundwater under their land than they can grazing cattle or sheep or goats or raising crops. And that's, of course, happened in the Panhandle out in West Texas, and then more recently in the area east of Austin.
So if I wanted, for instance, in my little two-acre plot in a basically residential area, if I wanted to drill for water, I could do that?
That's largely true. In fact, this happened about 3 or 4 years ago. We were going through a really serious drought throughout the state, but it was interesting. We did some mapping of the Austin area, mm-hmm. and as the city of Austin was passing really strict drought mitigation rules, telling people, basically you can't water your lawn, you can't wash your car. Some people just basically decided to opt out of that. They felt it was just too burdensome, and they drilled a well. And you can see it's fascinating because, hundreds of wells were drilled largely on the west side of Mopac.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are familiar with the geography of Austin,
I'm surprised you could drill.
Part of town, and uh-huh. and so there's a whole I think sort of difficult equity issue there, because mm-hmm. Some folks were sort of opting out of a social compact, in a sense, about how we were going to deal with water.
I would think it'd be hard to drill for water west of Mopac. Isn't it just all granite out there?
Well, you're right, the subsurface is super hard. I mean, it's limestone, and a lot of those wells cost over $10,000 to drill, and they have to go very deep.
Well, here in the Rio Grande Valley, the water table is so, I guess, high. I don't know if you call it high or low, but it's, the water table, you can hit it anyway in about 20 feet in many places. So I've heard of people just taking a tripod and putting a drill pipe in it and pounding it in with a sledgehammer, and they can actually, get water at 20 feet. But it's kind of, but it's brackish water. So, you can use it for household use and stuff, but you can drink it, but it's not very, it's very salty. And in fact, it's so salty that you can water coastal Bermuda with it, it'll be fine, but a lot of trees, you'll kill them. So it's not the best resource in the world, but it shows you how accessible it is and how people can actually, do their own wells because the water table is high. Let me back up just a minute. And, when a lot of people see the title of your book, The Texas Landscape Project, they might think in terms of a photography book that we're going to see pictures of Texas landscapes. But explain the title from your perspective.
Well, sure. Maybe I could back up a little bit if you don't mind.
No, that's fine.
This is the second book that our little nonprofit has done, the Conservation History Association of Texas, and the first book we did was a sort of compilation of oral history interviews that we did with conservationists across the state. We did about 230 of these interviews, and later made it into a book and a video archive. And the story there was that we were trying to get people's individual experiences and their perspectives about land and water and energy and air quality and public health and so on. So we came out with this book called The Texas Legacy Project, and our editor at Texas A&M said that she might be interested in a sequel. So we came back to her. It seemed like a very nice offer. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, how about a map book that instead of looking at things from the view of individuals and their personal experiences, how about thinking about it in terms of place, mm-hmm. and geography, and you know, watersheds and aquifers and ecoregions and all the things that make Texas up, all the pieces and parts of the state. And so getting to your question, you know, we try to think of a word that might span all those ideas of what makes Texas up. You know, what are the nuts and bolts that make this state up? And landscape seemed to be the most general term that would describe all those pieces of the Texas ecoregions and aquifers and the built world, you know, our cities and roads and other parts of infrastructure that we've built here.
Oh, it's wonderful just to peruse the book, because it's so visual, and you can just stop anywhere and study a particular graphic, and you can look at the great floods of Texas or flood plains and where it's likely to be, where flooding is a problem, and you can look at drought, and like you said, the built world, where we built things and where the intense civilization is. So it's fascinating just to sit and peruse it. You don't have to read it front to back.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, I don't know if there are some of your listeners out there, but I know that when I was growing up, I just loved, when we'd go on road trips with my parents, we'd get a AAA triptych, and, you know, this thing would unfold, and it would show our whole route that we would take with a big, they'd have a highlighted, you know, set of roads and streets and so on that we would take to get to our destination. And then we had these gas station maps and, and you know, the National Geographic maps that you'd see. And, I just think that, maps are cool.
They are cool. They are cool.
And I hope people feel that same way. And beyond that, I read an interesting little piece of factoid, you might say, that I guess 90% apparently of the information that comes into our brain is visual. You know, we are visual creatures, and apparently that signal, that visual signal that comes into our brain, we can process that 60,000 times faster than a piece of text. So, I mean, I take that to say that, you know, if you're reading a comic book or you're reading an atlas like ours, those pictures are going to tell you so much more and so much faster than the text, that an atlas can be a really powerful, accessible way to tell these stories.
Do you have a thesis in this book?
Well, you know, I think that we're trying to not be too heavy-handed with a thesis. I mean, we mostly wanted to draw on about 170 different sources, state, federal agencies, academic researchers, and so on, and we have about 300 maps in there, and you know, provide this big data in a kind of digestible form, so people can look at these maps and maybe make up their own minds about these really difficult, you know, long environmental problems we've had in the state, and not be lectured to too much. You know, provide some explanation what these maps mean. You know, try to interpret them, but not be too heavy-handed.
Yeah, I sense that, it's just a primarily an informational book, and, you know, you decide. You decide what this means, but it's clear when you look through it, if you are, I think, a reasonable human being, you see that with the growth of population, that's why I said, what will Texas look like in 100 years, we're facing enormous problems, and if we don't address them now, they're only going to get unaddressable later.
I think there's some truth to that. I mean, my grandfather was born in 1900 in Hearne, Texas, and at that time, the state was about 80% rural. Now, by the year 2000, 100 years later, we were a state made up of 80% of our residents lived in major cities. So we've had this huge shift towards cities. And yet, I think a lot of us still have this kind of lore that Texas is a rural place and it's largely wild. And I think that the mapping that we've done and the research that we've been able to do suggests that no, we're a very urban, populated, economically developed state. And it's you know, it's moved a long way from you know, the sort of mythic West kind of idea that I think a lot of us still you know, cling to and enjoy.
Well, you know, I was reading not long ago that when prior to 1836, when we got our independence from Mexico, there was a push to make Texas within Mexico its own province or state. It was part of Tamaulipas, right? And part of the problem that Santa Anna had with allowing Texas to be its own state and administer itself was that it didn't have 50,000 people. And that, and that was the kind of cutoff. When you get 50,000 people, then you can be a state, but you don't have that number, and so you can't be one.
Well, you know, I there's another sort of interesting idea that maybe would go with that same idea of very few people, that Texas at the same time also had an enormous amount of public land. You know, when Texas joined the Union in 1845, mm-hmm. it brought with it 225 million acres of public mm-hmm. land.
Yeah.
I mean, just the enormous mm-hmm. amount of open space that was owned by the state. And then
we went all the way up to Wyoming.
It was amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there have been a lot of interesting programs that the state took on to try to drive down its debt and to attract mm-hmm. Settlers and development. And so now we have, you know, maybe 3% public land. And so that's another thing that we kept running into when we were doing the Atlas, is that we have a very populated state, very economically developed place, but there isn't a lot of elbow room. There's not mm-hmm. a lot of public space that's available to visit and enjoy. So that's another sort of struggle I think that we're going to face in the years to come.
Now, does that 3% include the federal land that's owned here?
It does. Uh-huh. And you know, there's kind of an interesting sidelight, is that over the last, 15, 20 years, there's been a move away, from the federal government and the state governments being sort of the repository for a lot of our protected lands. Mm-hmm. And now there's over 1 million acres that's protected on what it's called a conservation easement that apply to private lands, to family farm and ranch lands, and it will help to keep those kind of lifestyles and those communities alive long into the future. And make sure that they're not, you know, converted into developed places. So that's, I think, a real heartening sign for the future, is that a lot of private individuals in Texas are taking it on themselves to try to keep Texas, Texas.
Do you have any problem with these large wind farms that are being created? I noticed that a lot of people find, let's say, the old ranch windmills, the old water mills, water windmills, they find those kind of beautiful and romantic, but the large, electric generating windmills, the turbines, a lot of people find ugly and undesirable, but yet they're growing by leaps and bounds, kind of, and I personally don't find them troublesome. I can find them kind of attractive if there aren't a million of them in my sight, but do you have any issue with that?
Well, I think it's like a lot of these conservation issues, you know. There are pluses and minuses. I think it's a wonderful thing that Texas now produces, I think, the most in wind power of any state in the union, over 14,000 megawatts. Mm-hmm. Earlier this winter, we produced, I think, over 40% of the electricity in the grid came from those turbines. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a carbon-free and relatively cheap source of energy, which I think is a good thing for the state. But like you said, there's some drawbacks.
Some aesthetic issues, I guess.
Aesthetics, it's really interesting. You know, there are people who worry about public health issues or, in a lot of these environmental problems. But there's some issues with billboards, and mm-hmm. I would think that wind turbines would be another that it's just, you know, in the eye of the beholder. It's some for some mm-hmm. people, it's a real mark on the landscape that they don't like.
Yes.
And not just the windmills, but the what they called the CREZ lines, which were those big transmission lines that brought power from the big wind fields out in the panhandle over to, you know, Dallas and Austin and the big cities in the eastern part of the state. So, there was, I think, a lot of struggle with what Texas should look like, especially in these rural areas that look much as they did when pioneers were crossing those hill country sites, 150 years ago.
Well, when I was young, I spent some time in Houston. I was there for 3 or 4 years, and as a young man, and I was I used to think of that, you know, Kevin Costner movie where he said that if you build it, they will come. And I used to think about Houston, that the mantra should be, if you don't build it, they still come. And so that seems to be true for Texas at large now. We are this huge economic engine, and people just keep coming and coming and coming. And we can't build fast enough, it seems, to keep up.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Is that how do you handle growth? Mm-hmm. Because I don't think you can turn the spigot off. You can't pull up the ladder. You've got to somehow come to some sort of a bargain with the future, in the sense of how are you going to build out the state so that we can all enjoy clean water and open space, but also mm-hmm. be able to raise our families and hold jobs down and so on.
Well, for instance, I-35 will never be finished. they're rebuilding it, as you know, and it will be, and when they finish it, it's not going to be big enough.
Well, that's true. I remember a friend told me once that he had gone to a wedding where the pastor said, "May you live as long as they are continuing to work on I-45," which I think converts to forever.
I-45, what is it, like 87 lanes now? It's just enormous. I think it's more like 6 on each side, but it's huge. It is just enormous. And I can remember when it was, I think, 3 lanes on each side. So they just keep building and building and building.
Well, and I wanted to, if you don't mind, riff a little bit on this idea of I-45 and I-35 and the changes that represents. Because, this atlas that we've created is a historical document. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we were trying to address was this thing called a shifting baseline. And that a lot of us think about the environment in terms of what we remember as we were children, and then we compare it with what we experience now. And the problem with that is that baseline, our childhood experience is always shifting. And mm-hmm. and I was thinking that when my mother was born in the 30s, the way she would travel out west of Houston was on US 90, which had 2 lanes.
Right.
And then when I was born, my first memories was that we would travel on Interstate 10, and there were 4 lanes. Mm-hmm. And then when my kids were born about 15 years ago, I-10 now has 16 lanes.
Wow.
So each of us remembers that as our starting point. Mm. But the starting point itself is shifting over the years. So in this atlas, we were trying to kind of do a freeze frame. This is what it's looked like in the past, and this is what it looks like now, and so that everybody can sort of share the same starting point. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think that's a beautiful analogy. I was going right with you of my own experience over all those years, and I was thinking just the other day of this tradition, since I grew up in a small town, this tradition of building a freeway that passes the town, bypasses the town and kills it. And I wondered if that, it certainly made traffic flow, but I wonder ultimately if that was good, because it really hurt, the rural life. And so these little towns would be circumvented and then die, and then people have to move to the cities, which causes greater congestion.
That's really interesting. And I think that it's a theme that I hope a lot of us will think about, that the choices we make in infrastructure, the reservoirs we build, the mm-hmm. highways we build, the canals that are dug, those choices have ramifications that are really hard to play out. There mm-hmm. there are lots of unintended consequences, mm-hmm. and there are sort of ripple effects that go decades into the future. And so I'm hoping that people will look at this atlas and sort of see the writing on the wall and try to, read the hieroglyphics and try to figure out, well, what does this mean for the future?
I like your chapter on Lights in the Night, where you have these maps of ambient light in the nighttime, or light pollution, sometimes it's called, the unfriendly description of it. But I've seen this on the internet in really bright form, and it's very impressive in a way to look that to see that, you know, the eastern part of Texas is practically under at night, you know, it's all lit up like it has one big street lamp over the whole eastern part of the state, and then you come down to the King Ranch area and it's just dark. You know, you have this little pocket of darkness. It'd be a great place to put an observatory there because it's just dark, more cattle than people. Same thing out in West Texas, beautiful pockets of darkness. And I say beautiful because, you know, I know the astronomers like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's again, such an interesting kind of dilemma is that I think that you know, light has often felt like home and the hearth and, you know, kind of feelings of safety and security going back, you know, to cavemen clustered around a fire. But, you know, as the years have gone on and we've, you know, since the advent of electric lights in particular, a lot of us are losing connection with, you know, one of the biggest parts of nature, which is the, you know, celestial field above us. Yeah. And so... It was interesting, sort of factoid again that most people growing up in the city do not know what the Milky Way is. They've never seen it because it's just too faint against the lights that are coming from all the street lights and the house lights and the, you know, lights of people's cars and so on. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me kind of a pretty tough trade-off. And I hope that people will start to appreciate that. You know, the night sky is a very, very beautiful and precious thing.
Well, you know, your city, Austin, was one of the first to put up night lighting in Texas, and the moonlight towers that you have there. And people complained that they wouldn't be able to sleep and that the grass would grow and they'd have to mow more often.
I love that. That's great.
Well, I wish we had time to, we're running out quickly, unfortunately, but this is just a wonderful book, everything from lights to fire ants to buffalo, and the buffalo chapter is great because it shows how we took essentially an environmental problem and brought it back from the brink and revitalized the buffalo population through the work of some very good people like Charles Goodnight and others who were visionaries in many, many ways. So the other thing I wanted to say about my response to the book is it is a heavy book and well worth the money. There it is, just full of beautiful information, and so I love what you've done here. This, how long did it take to do this? This when I looked at it, I said this is decades.
Well, I was lucky to have Jonathan Ogren, you know, preparing these maps and being a goad and a good friend to make it happen. But it took about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the maps are just, I mean, clearly you're getting them from so many places. You're getting them from, as you said, government agencies and others that have collected this data in from many different quadrants of society.
That's true, and I think that part of this atlas is really a recognition of the, you know, many fine scientists and agency officials out there that collect data, you know, day in and day out, and they're putting it on the web and making it available to us to sort of learn about our natural world, and I think that's a wonderful gift to us and to posterity.
Well, usually I cover this information before I get into the interview. I'm kind of doing it backwards, but I was so pumped about the book that I jumped right in there. Your background is you're an attorney, but do you practice law at the moment?
I do not. No, I don't. That's right.
What is your occupation at the moment?
It turns out I've ended up being an author, but I spent about half my time helping my family in the land and cattle business.
Oh.
We're in the ranching industry.
That's right. I read that there. I read that you're in that you raise cattle, so you are a man of experience in the rural world.
Well, it's been a humbling experience because I, you know, practiced as an environmental lawyer for a number of years, and asked people to do all sorts of difficult things to protect Mother Nature. And then, you know, my other hat is trying to do those things on the ground and trying to deal with drought and other inconveniences. And I've started to realize how difficult conservation can be. And I have got to hand it off to people that you know, work hard every day to try to keep our industries clean, and I know it's not an easy job.
Well, this gives you special credibility because you have lived on both sides of this environmental fence, you might say.
I feel a little schizophrenic sometimes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, David. We've been talking with David Todd, who is author or co-author of the Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People. Fascinating book to just spend hours perusing. So I suggest that you pick it up. For Good Books Radio, I'm Dr. W.F. Strong. Good to have you today. And signing off, here's hoping that all your books are good reads.